There's been a prescription drug out for about, 57 years that is needed now more than ever. What I'm referring to is an overdose medication called naloxone, or by its brand name, Narcan. With the exponential rise in opioid addiction and abuse, this drug is saving thousands of lives. This is how it works. Opioids, as you probably know, are depressants. They slow everything in the body down. And what often kills someone is the slowing down of the respiratory system to a point of zero function. You basically suffocate to death. Narcan is injected and sweeps the opioids off of the neural receptor sites, basically throwing the victim into immediate withdrawal. The wonder of this drug inspired the formation of a nonprofit organization in Ohio in 2012 called DAWN, which stands for Deaths Avoided with Naloxone. But the drug, many doctors say, is no silver bullet. Overdose victims can sometimes still OD even after its administration. And there's nothing that removes the addiction from the individual, so that once they leave the hospital, they may then go back to that same habit and later die. As the EMS director in Ohio stated, he doesn't know what the answer is exactly. For naloxone can save lives, but it can't change life habits or turn the tide of the epidemic. But at least, it can give a person another chance. The Lazarus effect has been a term used in such administrations, or even in cases where someone has been declared dead or well on their way and they're brought back to life through extraordinary measures. Today, we examine that text, where that name comes from, how it all began. The original Lazarus is not a prominent character in this story, but he is the centerpiece of a sign. If you recall in John's Gospel, there are several signs pointing to the fact that Jesus is the Messiah of God, one in nature with the one triune God. It began in chapter 2 at a wedding in Cana when, after protesting to his mother, he finally transforms the water into wine, and it culminates here, the seventh and final sign, days before he'll be arrested and convicted and crucified. The disciples, leading up to this text today, think Jesus has a death wish by going back to the same village where the people tried to stone him to death for claiming to be one with God. "Blasphemy, blasphemy," they shouted. And then upon hearing the news of Lazarus' illness, Jesus calmly seems to declare that it's not terminal, and he hangs out a little longer where he was. One thing you can never say about Jesus is that he is rash. He seems to always be calm, cool, and collected. Finally, when he arrives, he is given the news that Lazarus is dead. So much for Jesus' prediction, you might say. Yet he still seems to calmly say, "Let's go ahead and see him." Now, a debate has raged over the centuries. Was Lazarus really dead? Scientific reasoning aside, even biblical scholars have debated this, calling the story sometimes the resuscitation of Lazarus. And yet, if you read the text closely, you'll see that he was dead 4 days. In the Jewish tradition, this idea was it took 4 days for the soul to complete the journey from this life to death. The soul no longer lingers near the body, which indicates that Lazarus is as dead as a doornail. The boundary line has been fixed. There's no coming back. At least that's what Mary and Martha think, and also the crowd who had gathered that day. In the case of Mary and Martha, they believe in the resurrection, but it's some distant, far-off reality. Resurrection will happen, they believe, but it won't affect right now, this situation. In our experience, there are this world certainties from which there seems to be no return, no going back. There are those whom the world deems economically or socially, physically or spiritually or even emotionally dead. We often pray for the power of the resurrection in the lives of persons and communities bound by the grave clothes of war and genocide, poverty, disease, dis-ease, systematic abuse, and systematic oppression. But often I think if we're honest with ourselves, we are somewhat like Mary and Martha. We don't see a resurrection happening in this world. I recently returned from a trip in Haiti. I think I told you last week that's where I grew this. It doesn't seem to want to go away. This country, by most of the world, has been declared dead economically. It's really hard to see how the people could become self-sustaining. The government is corrupt. It takes people's lands without giving them any remuneration. It pockets assistance money. It exploits people. Poverty is rampant. It's hard to believe in this nation resurrection is possible. Just this morning, I was listening to the radio, and there was a woman who had grown up in the United States, but she's Haitian in her descendancy, and she was talking about how she even has a hard time seeing a future for the people where there's much hope. And so it's easier to believe the resurrection at the end of time will sort all these things out in the by and by. But Jesus did a few things in response to this news I want you to pay attention to. First, he joined Martha and Mary in their grief. Verse 35 is, maybe you know, the shortest verse of the Bible. The New Revised Standard Version expands it, but it basically is Jesus wept. Why? If he was God, as he claimed, why would death move him to tears? After all, is he not the Lord of both the dead and the living? The only reason I can think of is that when he took upon himself our nature, he took on all our emotion. He took on the distress that overwhelms us when our loved ones suffer and die. Yes, he was indeed distressed. The word in the Greek carries a sense that he groaned. His distressed state was beyond words. He was in deep emotional pain. And yet, he did not let that stop him. He took charge and ordered what would have seemed absurd. Take away the stone. And in a loud voice, he raised the dead. The raising of Lazarus serves to signify that God's end time promises are present now, here, being realized amid and in spite of the ordinariness of the course of life, which includes all this stuff, illness and death and burials. Jesus' resurrection promise does not depend on human faith. Notice that in the text, but it does call it forth. This narrative should compel us to consider the possibility of resurrection in the lives of many persons and communities who deeply need God's presence to experience the newness, the inbreaking of the resurrection. It invites us to dream beyond the boundaries that our society has set of what is possible. In Haiti, I saw poverty and corruption and suffering, but I also saw people claiming the resurrection for their communities, uniting together by the presence and power of the Holy Spirit, going into the tombs and calling forth life by the authority of Jesus Christ. I met teachers who came from the United States, from Rhode Island, to teach children in Haiti during their winter break, delivering school supplies, bringing good news, saying, "We love you." I met a Haitian teacher who was raised in the United States and moved back to Haiti to start an organization called Teach Haiti to establish schools of excellence to give students a chance who have very little. I saw farmers claiming the richness of God's good creation to start gardens, to build cisterns to collect water, and to build seed banks to store the seeds when the storms would wipe their crops away. I saw peasant farmer representatives from different departments, or that we like our states, traveling hours on harsh roads in hot taxis to meet and discuss how to make life better for all Haitians. I saw the power of the resurrection, and I joined in that dream beyond the boundaries for a beautiful children of Haiti. God is in Haiti. God is with the people. Resurrection is happening. Jesus, after all, did not say, I will be the resurrection and the life. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Jesus gave us a dream beyond the boundaries. If you believe this, you will join next week and rise against hunger.